From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, confusion and frustration in Ann Arbor over whether schools will reopen.
We've been hearing for months from parents in Ann Arbor who are very upset by this.
Also, the future of black spaces in Detroit. Can the city be complete without recreational space for most of the city's residents?
It's really interesting that we have to be intentional about having black spaces in a black city. Why aren't all the spaces just our spaces?
And if you're starting to feel a little cooped up in pandemic winter, maybe it's time to pick up a new outdoorsy hobby.
During the winter is a great time to start birding because there are not as many birds, so it's not quite as intimidating, and they're a lot easier to see.
All that and more coming up today. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, former Michigan House Speaker Lee Chatfield resigns from a new job after pushback for his stance on LGBTQ rights while in Lansing. More on that story is coming up later today. But first, this week, one of the last Michigan school districts to stay online will make a decision soon about whether to return to class. And boy, the protracted process at Ann Arbor Public Schools has caused some fury among parents. And with us to set the stage is a reporter who's been covering the district. Ron French is with Bridge, Michigan. Ron, welcome back to Stateside.
It's a pleasure to be here.
There has been some confusion about what Ann Arbor's school board decided or did not decide last week about returning to the classroom. Can you bring us up to speed?
Well, I'm just as confused as everybody else, I'm afraid. But the way I was reading what they did is that the school board was recommending that the majority of Ann Arbor students remain in virtual learning for the rest of the school year. Anyone who's familiar with that meeting knows it wasn't even clear whether the school board members were certain what they were voting on. But it really does point out just the confusion around this issue in a couple of cities, and Ann Arbor is the prime example of that.
The article that you wrote starts with a parent, Nicholas Bagley, losing it over a virtual snow day that was called for Ann Arbor Public Schools after just having 2 days off for a sort of mid-semester break. And he was just really upset that district leaders seem to be finding ways to keep kids out of school, at least for the snow day, which the district said was something that they thought kids needed to, you know, play and enjoy the weather a little bit. Have you heard from other parents or teachers who feel the same way Nicholas Bagley does?
We've been hearing for months from parents in Ann Arbor who are very upset by this. There is a group that has a lot of physicians in it that is very upset and arguing that schools are safe. And the problem is it's a no-win situation for everybody. You have basically about half the parents who desperately want their students back in class. You've got a large portion of parents also who continue to be worried and don't want their students in class. You've got studies that you can point to a backup whatever point of view you want to have. But it's a tough situation, and really when you get down to it, there are only two large school districts left in the state that either have not reopened or have plans to reopen.
At this point, we've got a petition from parents, a legal fund created to sue the district, and a statement from Ann Arbor City Council. I believe that latter statement doesn't really have any legal teeth to it. But the city's leaders wanted to say that they think it's important for kids to have the option to get back to school. Anecdotally, we've heard about parents taking their kids out of AAPS or exploring in-person options at private schools. Do you think there's anything inherently different about the reaction in Ann Arbor compared with some of the other districts around the state?
I think there's a little bit there. Part of it may be, I think in the early months of the pandemic and in the first months of the school year in September and October, there may have been a bit of a reaction to the fact that that then President Trump was pushing for schools to reopen so much. And Ann Arbor is a very Democratic city. And so if you had some people who were, I think, looking at it and saying if this president who has some issues probably with telling the truth at times, was pushing it so much, there was some concern. But there's also a couple of things there we need to keep in mind. The other area that had a lot of schools that put off returning students for a long time were centered around East Lansing, you know. So the two largest university towns were areas where people were more concerned. And the health departments in those counties were also more concerned because in the fall they had very high rates of COVID in those on those campuses. There's also a fact right now that Washtenaw County has what looks to be the lowest rate of teacher vaccination in the state. And that is obviously a concern.
What do we know about the reasons for the low rate of teacher vaccination in Washtenaw County?
It's unclear. Everyone I've spoken to is not certain why that is the way it is. I know that Governor Whitmer prioritized teachers, but it's up to the individual counties, that their health departments, to determine how they're distributing those vaccinations. In Ingham County, where Michigan State University is located, they've been very good about like prioritizing teachers in districts that are in person first, then those had plans to return, and last the districts that still had not announced plans to return. Washtenaw County was sort of more open about that. It was like teachers can come. But there is, you got to realize with Ann Arbor Public Schools being so large, it's one of the top five districts in the state as far as school enrollment. That's a heck of a lot of teachers you got to get vaccinated. And you also have to go through all the doctors at U of M and senior citizens. So it's tough to get everyone's shots as quickly as we'd like.
Given the level of reaction that we've seen from parents and people in the community, do you think that's going to have an impact on what the school board decides to do this year?
I would suspect it's almost untenable that they continue to have the vast majority of students not at least have an option of returning to school. And I think that's what parents want. They're not saying we demand that every kid be back at their desk. They're saying, let's give everyone an option of at least a hybrid model where they can be in class a few days a week, because we know how important that is both for academics, but also for social development.
How has the superintendent for Ann Arbor and the school board responded so far to this? It seems like there was a bit of a lag between the school board meeting where this really became an issue and where the district decided to respond and try to clarify its position on what actually happened.
Sure. Well, I've spoken to the superintendent a few times, and she's in a no-win situation. She's feeling pressure from both sides on this. The teachers' union in Ann Arbor has been very reticent about returning to the classroom for health reasons, and you are in Ann Arbor, which is the hotspot in the state from COVID-19 variant that is considered more contagious. And you also have, in the last couple of weeks, the CDC at the national level came out with recommendations for reopening schools that if you follow their guidelines, no school in Washtenaw County would be open. So it's tough. You also put yourself in a position, if you're a school leader, saying if we put everyone back in school and students, when the CDC is recommending they should not be open, and someone gets sick and God forbid dies, are we held liable?
The CDC's guidelines, I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. The calculations involve weekly case totals. Does that give us a very different picture of what's going on in schools and counties than if we were to look at the district's daily average?
Well, the problem with using a daily average is that they fluctuate so much. And so you'd have a school that could be open one day and then be told they have to close the next day. So you have to look at it over a larger period of time. The issue that has come up with the CDC guidelines is they are much more conservative than anyone was anticipating. Michigan has one of the two or three lowest rates of COVID in the nation right now. Yet, if you follow the CDC guidelines, 49 out of our 83 counties would not have schools open. And so the issue is, I don't think, is with whether you're counting on a daily basis or a weekly basis. It's the fact that they set the metrics at such a low bar.
Yeah. Bridge did write a story that had to be corrected over this confusion. Do you think that there are districts that are maybe looking at different metrics and that's why they're reaching different conclusions and maybe going a different way than CDC guidelines would suggest?
Oh, absolutely. I think most schools, there are very few teachers out there who wouldn't rather be in class, and there are no superintendents who wouldn't rather have their schools open. But they are all working with their county health departments. That's what the mandates are from the state. Schools can make their own decisions, but they are ordered to like work with the health department to try to figure out what metrics to use to determine whether it's safe to be reopened. Most of the county health departments, particularly as the rates have gone down here in the last month or two, and seeing some studies that have come out that seem to indicate that transmission in schools is lower than what people had feared, a lot of districts are making decision that, you know, it's might be safe to reopen it. And one more thing, if I have time, is to say that there was a Michigan State University study that indicated the possibility that schools are actually safer than homes in some districts because of all the safety precautions that are taken into account in classrooms.
Who are the other holdouts left in the state right now, and how are these questions being handled there?
Kalamazoo is the major holdout at the moment. They have decided, they've taken a vote and just a few weeks ago and said, we are not returning at all this school year, which I commend them to the point that they were not letting parents hang. You know, it's like we made a decision, it's too late. We're just going to continue with virtual learning. And from their point of view, what they did is they did surveys and they found that a majority of parents and teachers and staff all preferred to stay virtual for the rest of the year. And it was interesting that in the Kalamazoo's example, the superintendent admitted, well, if we were just going by science, we'd have the schools open. So really, that's an odd position to be in as a superintendent. Say, yeah, by science, we should have our kids in classrooms, but the majority of our parents say they don't want to, so we're not going to do it. The other large district that had been a holdout was Lansing, and just a few nights ago, they voted to set a date to return.
Ron French covers education for Bridge Michigan. Ron, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Next up, how a changing Detroit might create new spaces that center its Black residents. Stay tuned. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Detroit is in a period of such rapid change. The boom years interrupted by COVID brought new investment and new faces. Some of those people come for business, some for the community. All need places to gather and relax. We wanted to take some time during this month of recognizing Black history to remember the spaces where Black people have gathered in Detroit and to see what it means now to create spaces that welcome and include Black Detroiters. It is a city that is majority Black. With us today is Lauren Hood, an urban planner and leading thinker in Afro-urbanist design. Lauren, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
And P.G. Watkins is here, too. They're the founder and director of the Black Bottom Archives, which preserve the memories of Detroit's Black Bottom neighborhood for future generations. P.G., welcome. It's good to have you.
Hey, what up, though? I'm excited to be here.
So, Lauren, can I just start with you? The last time we spoke, you invoked the spirit and imagination that are really essential to Afro-urbanism. Maybe we better just reset terms for folks who might not have been with us at that point. What does Afro-urbanism mean in the context of thinking about the city's future?
Well, it's really, really pretty simple. It just means centering the lived experience, the hopes, dreams, and aspirations of Black people in the planning and development in Black neighborhoods. And it seems really elementary, but we don't do it that way presently.
What is the difference between planning with communities and truly making space to dream with them?
Well, I think what's tough right now is people, we've been robbed of our imagination. So if you're in a living situation where most of your day is spent in survival mode, you don't really have the imagination to think about what you want for your future. So I think that it's up to us that practice planning and development to to make space for that and encourage that. So, but first we have to acknowledge what people are going through. I think we don't do a good job of understanding the history that got us here. A lot of my colleagues in planning and development just look at a neighborhood in its current state and assume the people that are there are at fault. But really it's a lot of policy violence, a lot of disinvestment, a lot of things that weren't in our control. It's not Black Detroiters' fault that communities look the way they do. A lot has happened to us and to our communities that, you know, we had no control over. And I think a basic understanding of that changes how you approach what could happen in that place in the future.
I guess that brings us to your work, PG, with Black Bottom Archives. Could you talk for a little bit as we get started here about the type of space that Paradise Valley and Black Bottom occupied for Black Detroiters and why you wanted to start the archive?
Yes. So it is more common knowledge today than it was several years ago about what Black Bottom and Paradise Valley were, particularly in the period between the 40s and the 60s, where really my work focuses on when the neighborhood started to be demolished. But the area during that time in the early 1900s was a majority Black working class neighborhood and commercial district. It's where you had a lot of the cultural center for Black Detroit. So a lot of the jazz clubs and performance halls, local businesses, doctors, pharmacies, stores, right? All of that was in Black Bottom and Paradise Valley. They had schools and churches that were also in that area. And a lot of there was a lot of residential area. And essentially, the part of the story that gets talked about most often is the fact that the neighborhood Black Bottom was run through with I-375, which is the freeway that we know goes through downtown Detroit now. And this process was in the period of urban renewal, right? This federal government program that was trying to, in the same ways that we might see right now, revitalize the city, remove blight, right? Make it more appealing to visitors, to business people, to the corporate class. What's happening now in Black Detroit and what's happened then are very related, right? A lot of what Lauren was even just talking about, the policy violence of urban renewal, and the policy violence we're seeing today with the ways that folks are displaced, these mass foreclosures that happened because of unconstitutional tax assessments, and just the ways that we're seeing the weaponization of infrastructure, the ways that freeways and highways are prioritized or corporate development, private property is prioritized over people's homes, right? People's families, the businesses that sustain communities. So really what got us wanting to start the archives about 6 years ago was this idea that the stories that were being told about Detroit weren't being told in their full truth and their full complexity. And so, yeah, we wanted to be some of the voice and some of the narrative around what's true for Black Detroiters and all of its nuance.
This is a pretty considerable pile of narrative that we're talking about here. Given that we need to be mindful of renewal not taking priority over people's actual lived experience, what does that mean when we start to think about recreation and entertainment spaces and how those places were treated in Black Bottom?
Oh, this is a good question. It's really juicy. I'm trying to think through my answer because part of what gets me a little riled up about renewal and revitalization when it comes to recreation and entertainment spaces is that because so much of it is privatized, people who are actually supposed to be enjoying these places, right? And we think about mostly poor Black people who might visit these places are often criminalized, right? Kept out for a number of reasons. There are barriers to entry. There are requirements for being in there. There's ways that if you don't fit the part of what you're supposed to, like who's supposed to be there, then you might get kicked out or criminalized in other ways. And that's what I mean. I've seen as a young Black Detroiter in the spaces that are being renewed in terms of like downtown. But in terms of Black Bottom's history, Paradise Valley was one of the key places for entertainment and culture. It was one of the places that where it was kind of integrated before most other places were in terms of like, even though Black folks couldn't necessarily stay at the same hotels as white folks, they would be able to perform there. They might be able to go to the same shows, right? There was a lot of ways that entertainment and recreation was a big part of what made that area be considered thriving in its time and from a historical perspective.
Well, Lauren Hood, what do you think about as the starting point for creating spaces that affirm and are welcoming to the people who actually, Black people living in the city?
Well, I think first, it's really interesting that we have to be intentional about having Black spaces in a Black city. Why aren't all the spaces just our spaces? And you know, that people that are new here can be thinking about how to create spaces, you know, that reflect what they want to see. So for starters, I think we have to kind of shift the narrative about who the protagonist is in the Detroit story. Like, I think we have it wrong. The protagonist is the Black folks. It's an 80% Black city. And we kind of talk about it when we say words like inclusion, we're talking about including Black people. And I think we have, you know,
that's backwards.
Yeah, it's backwards. The focus just needs to be back on the majority population for starters. Mm-hmm. And when you look at, oddly enough, all of the quote unquote public spaces in our downtown area, there are all these public private kind of relationships that are managed by mostly white led institutions. So when you look at like the Downtown Detroit Partnership and all, it oversees all of the public space downtown. So even when you look at what is thought to be like a public park, it's for everybody. You know, the programming is done by a private group who isn't reflective of the majority population of the city.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Lauren Hood, an urbanist and consultant based in Detroit, and P.G. Watkins, founder and director of the Black Bottom Archives. Lauren Hood, what are some of the ways that design itself sometimes reinforces divisions in subtle ways?
Well, I'm a process person, so I always want to know how we arrived at something. So when I see a program at a public space, I'm like, how did you decide that was the thing to do? You know, what kind of conversations were had? Where were the conversations had? Who was invited? Who was doing the inviting? I mean, it all comes down to the kind of process. And if you're co-creating something, you're giving citizens like real agency in a process, you have outcomes that reflect that. So when I see programming that isn't reflective of us, I can kind of, you know, I know who was at the table and I know how the conversation went.
Mm-hmm. Are there,
and even, can I jump in here?
Please
real quick
do.
Too?
Please.
Because this is something I think about. Lauren and I both went through the same community development master's program. And one of the things that it always has stuck with me since one of my physical development classes there was the idea of like the intentionality of what gets put in a space, like thinking about even like, where is there a table for someone to sit at and where is there not, right? And these ways, these really subtle ways that physical design does encourage us or not to stay in a place or tell us that we're welcome to stay in a place. And this is coming from a perspective of like an oppressed or marginalized person who is just used to not have, like, not just making space, right? Like, you could maybe talk to a white person who sees just the open area and is like, oh yeah, of course I could set up here. And I mean, Black folks feel that way too. And also there are ways that design welcomes people to be like, yeah, come here, sit down, have a meal, invite your folks here. Like, this is a gathering place versus like, you're only here if you're invited or if we've set it up in a very particular way for your particular group to be here, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And another thing, you know what gives me the jeebies about the downtown parks? A friend and I once counted the number of cameras pointed at the open spaces. So when you are talking about being policed in public spaces, like a camera pointed at what is supposed to be a recreational space signals to Black folks in particular, you know, that we got to watch our step.
Literally,
that, and I mean, someone's okay, so watching. I, yeah,
but right. what you're saying makes me think about even when in the first moment of COVID, right, where we're just like, what is this thing that's happening? What is this pandemic? What does it mean for how we gather or can't gather? We saw the city take down basketball rims, right? We saw the city police and ticket and arrest in some cases groups of people who are gathering outside of stores or in parks. Black people, young Black people, right? And then to see in some, we were driving and it was like, okay, there was clearly in our areas of the city, like there were no basketball rims on any of the public parks. But then you would see in some places like, oh, there's still rims there. You know, like they didn't take down everything at this place, you know? And so just thinking about those subtle ways that, yeah, we're always being surveilled and what that does to our ability to truly enjoy ourselves. And also how deliberately they're like, don't even try to. And I mean, okay, in the name of the pandemic, it wasn't safe to do that type of stuff anyway. And also, right, like the ways that infrastructure is used to keep us out of places really explicitly and also really subtly.
PG, can you, as you do look around the city, I want to be mindful of your point, or maybe it was Lauren said it first, that a lot of the spaces that we do have in the city right now were not designed with Black Detroiters in mind. But given what we have, are there places of opportunity that you see, or places that have developed somewhat organically a more welcoming environment?
Yeah, I feel like there are some ways that we are needing to think about the reasons that in this very Black city that has been a very Black city, like why it has been such a Black city, why our spaces have been this way. Also, what was the cost, like the supreme disinvestment that has happened in this city over several decades, right? Like we were able to kind of pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, right? Like there was, I think Detroit had one of the cities that had like the highest percentage of Black home ownership at one time. And just thinking about all the ways that Black folks were thriving here, right? But that was because we had to. Like that was because the city, the state, the federal government decided we weren't worth investing in. And not even just Black folks, but Black and brown folks, right? Indigenous people, the folks who have been here, who have stayed here despite being told that our youth were not worth schools, right? Like so many schools closed all across neighborhoods in the city because folks decided it wasn't worthwhile to keep them open or to continue investing in them. And I think there's an opportunity for a true acknowledgement of that and to, in some ways, right the course.
Lauren Hood, how would you answer this question about our spaces of opportunity?
I feel like, you know, in recent years, we've been like, oh, we need to get more Black folks, more Native Detroiters at the table. But what I have seen is that when we are at the table, because of what we may be dealing with outside of these conversations, it's not even a fair conversation, if that makes sense. And I think, again, it starts with acknowledging the history, acknowledging these survival modes that people have to live in. We're calling people to the table to talk about, hey, what are your best ideas for the future of your neighborhood? But, you know, people are trying to figure out how to stay in their houses, how to get their water back on. People are underemployed. There are all these things that people have to contend with, and we're asking them to come to the table as if they're whole and ready for the conversation about their community's future. So I feel like we have to be better prepared to have different kinds of conversations with people. I think that last year's paradigm shift after George Floyd kind of encouraged more empathy. I would like to see that amongst my fellow planners and development practitioners. I feel like a lot of folks, if you aren't a person of color or from a community that has seen challenges, you kind of approach community development in an academic way. And when you're from one of these communities, you approach it more as like an agent of change kind of way. Like we have a sense of responsibility about stewarding our communities in the right way into the future. And I think that people that don't come from our communities keep it at arm's length, and it's a very academic practice. And you know, you can distance yourself from any emotion and empathy. And I think that is at the core of how it's so easy to put a freeway through a community that had doctors, lawyers. You know, we always talk about when we hear about Black Bottom about the nightclubs and the restaurants and the bars, but there were also like doctors, lawyers, beauty salons, barbershops, confectionaries. There were all manner of businesses that Black folks owned in that community. And we don't take into consideration, you know, everything that gets lost. If you can think about the intergenerational wealth that was lost when those businesses got shut down, like what might those families have been able to hand down to their kids had they been able to keep those businesses? We don't think about the political will that was lost when you take away community ties. It was a tightly knit community. So yes, because of segregation, the doctor had to live next to the janitor. And there's a benefit to that. There was a strong political will in those communities. And how does that get broken down when you, you know, you put the freeway through? So there are all these things that happen that are lost that we don't think about. And I think we need to start with history. We need to rely on empathy, understand what people are going through when we're asking them to come to a table. The tables are happening across the city all the time. And I think we as planners need to go find where those conversations are happening and go be there versus trying to get people to come to where we're at and have the kind of conversation that we as planners are having. I think folks in community are already having the right kind of conversations. We just need to plug into those.
Lauren Hood is an urban planner and consultant based in Detroit. We've also been talking today with P.G. Watkins, an organizer, also the founder and director of the Black Bottom Archives. P.G., Lauren, thank you so much for being with us. It's good to hear your voices.
You too.
Yeah, this was fun.
Thanks for giving me an excuse to talk to P.G. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, ditto.
And this is not the end of the conversation. Come back and listen later this week for our chat with folks in Idlewild, Michigan, about returning to this more rural part of the state, a space that was developed with Black people in mind. We need to take a short break now. When we come back, we'd like to introduce you to some of the neighbors.
As we're experiencing more mild winters further south, a lot of our birds that would normally migrate aren't migrating because they don't need to.
We'll teach you how to get started with backyard bird watching in a great year to see many different species. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. You may not have been aware of this, but Michigan's had quite an eruption this winter. I'm not talking about lava or even an ice volcano, but an eruption spelled with an I. That means that we're talking birds. It's been a great year for winter birding. With us now is Michigan Audubon Education Coordinator Lindsay Kane. Lindsay, welcome.
Thanks for having me, April.
So let's start with the eruption that I was just alluding to. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so an eruption with birds is when you get northern wintering birds that come down south for the winter because they're not finding enough food. So a lot of the species that exhibit eruptive behavior are birds that would typically overwinter in the boreal forest. And because there isn't a large pine crop this year, there's not a lot of pine cones and a lot of seeds, they're moving to find food for the winter, which is a really great experience for a lot of birders because we're seeing a lot of things that we wouldn't normally see over the winter.
What are some of the birds that we are seeing this year that we might not in a normal year?
So we get a lot of winter finches that will exhibit eruptive behavior. And so this year, we're seeing a lot of purple finch, red poles, pine siskins, evening grosbeak, and actually even red-breasted nuthatch, which is a bird that we see further south during the winter, but we're seeing a lot more of this year.
Lindsay, I don't know if you know, but is there anything that we can point to in this year's climate that might account for the difference in what we're seeing in terms of the bird populations?
Well, I think that one thing to note is this is actually a pretty typical behavior for birds and has been for a long time. Although we are seeing a lot of birds that have changed their wintering grounds and their ranges because of climate change, as we're experiencing more mild winters further south, a lot of our birds that would normally migrate aren't migrating because they don't need to, but the climate can definitely have an impact on our forests and pine cone production and all of that as well. But this is a pretty typical behavior for a lot of our winter finches.
Generally speaking, what does winter birding look like in Michigan? Are there some regional differences?
So there are definitely regional differences if you look at big regions of the state. The UP obviously gets different birds than we're going to get in southern Michigan. And even in the lower peninsula, the northern half gets a little bit different birds than the southern half. But overall, we see pretty similar birding experiences throughout the state. Birding in Michigan during the winter is a great time to start birding because there are not as many birds, so it's not quite as intimidating, and they're a lot easier to see without all of the leaves and with those white backdrops, those birds really pop. So it's a really great time to start exploring the birds in your own backyard.
Yeah, it's really hard to miss a cardinal or a finch.
Definitely.
What are some of the best backyard birding starters? I mean, is there anything special? Do you even need a pair of binoculars if you're starting at the hyper-local level?
No, I think that's one of the great parts about birding is that anybody can do it anywhere, right? Birds are all around us and you can find them in your own backyard and especially in the winter, right? Like you said, really easy to see those colors. So one of the most important things if you really want to see birds up close is to have a bird feeder. But if you have a bird feeder near your backyard, in your backyard or near you, you can find and start to learn all kinds of different birds without any equipment.
It seems like we've rounded some kind of turn, at least in Southeast Michigan, and there are more species sounding off in the mornings. Dare one hope that what we're hearing from birds is a suggestion that spring might be on the way?
I think that is definitely probably what's happening. So there are a lot of birds that are starting to come back up to their breeding grounds. It seems really early to us when we think about it. You look around and there's a lot of snow, but a lot of these birds start to come to their territory early to be able to find a good place. And by mid-March, they might even be starting to build their nests.
What are some of the birds that are easier to identify that we might want to start out looking for if you're new to this?
So one of the best backyard birds that is here all year round, in my opinion, is the black-capped chickadee. And part of the reason is they're really distinctive. They've got a black cap, you know, their head is black, as their name would suggest, and a black bib with these white cheeks. And so there's a big contrast. They're pretty small birds, but they're really charismatic and like to flit around a lot. So they're really entertaining to watch. And so I think that's a really great bird for a lot of people to start looking for. And you can see it all year round, which is really exciting.
They are great fans of those winter bird feeders, that's for sure.
Yes.
I have a crazy thing I want to ask you about. I heard the wildest story recently about crows. Now, I know that when most people are thinking about bird watching, they may not be thinking of crows. But someone I know who lives in a different part of the country talked about feeding crows in her neighborhood and actually seeing a response from them, like they were starting to congregate, and actually seemed kind of protective of her when, like, she was talking to neighbors outdoors. Is that something you've ever heard of before?
Oh, yeah, that's actually a quite common story when you're referring to crows. They're very intelligent birds, and they really have a memory that they keep and pass along to other family members, if you will. And so they learn very well and they remember things. And so it makes them really interesting birds to watch and pay attention to because you can see trends and a lot of differences and changes, but also a lot of similarities.
So would it be possible if you were feeding crows in a backyard type environment that you might cultivate your own private flock, or I guess if I'm being grammatically correct, your own private murder?
I mean, I guess it's definitely possible. The only thing that I would note is that even if you're feeding those crows, there might be better eats somewhere else, and so, or so to speak. So they may not flock to you as much as you would like, but if you've got something good and there's not anything else good around, you could definitely have your own murder of crows.
Are there any species that you'd recommend that birdwatching veterans might be seeking out right now, something a little bit more rare?
Well, I know that if we think about a normal winter, one of the more rare birds that a lot of birders go after is the snowy owl. That's a really exciting bird that we're only going to see in Michigan during the winter and only if they need to be here. So this winter, actually, there's not as many snowy owls as there have been in the past, but that's a really great bird for a lot of birders to try and find throughout the winter.
What are the best places to look for a snowy owl?
So snowy owls, the best place to go is the UP. And I have been on several trips to the UP in the winter to see snowy owls. And to me, it never gets old. They are sometimes further downstate. I was actually looking at the state map from eBird reports where birders track the sightings that they've seen. And there have been some seen in the lower part of the Lower Peninsula this year, but the UP is really the best place to be able to see them. There's those open fields for them to be able to hunt, and it's still a lot cooler up there, which is more their cup of tea.
When I think of a snowy owl, is this the same one we might imagine accompanying Harry Potter to Hogwarts.
Exactly.
Nice. Since we are in a Great Lakes state, I'm assuming that winter birding includes at least some kinds of waterfowl. What kinds of ducks and geese are around right now?
Yeah, so this is a great time to be learning your ducks and geese, because as long as there is open water, there are ducks and geese all over the place. So you'll see something as simple as your mallard duck, which is something that I think most of us are familiar with, whether you're a birder or not. But there's also mergansers and sculp. There's some, of course, Canada geese, but also cackling geese in certain places. But waterfowl are really big for a lot of birders during the winter. This is when they go kind of scoop them up so that they can see them for their year.
You know, when I was researching this topic, I ran across the phrase birding ethics. Can you explain what that means as the Audubon Society defines it?
Yeah, so birding ethics are a really important part of birding, and it's something that I don't think we often pay a lot of attention to. A lot of birders understand birding ethics, and it makes sense when you start thinking about it. It's very logical, but it's often difficult for us to remember when you haven't started to spend a lot of time around birds. But they are creatures that need some space and respect in terms of the environment where we're out hiking and bird watching is their home. And so we have to be careful about interrupting them. And a lot of people think about interrupting them during nesting and breeding season as being the only time of year where it's important. But it's important all year round. Take the snowy owls, for example. They need a lot of space to be able to hunt, and we don't want them to be conditioned to humans. So there are people out there who will think, oh, I want to get a really great photo. Let me put out some mice and draw them in. Well, those lures can be really dangerous to a snowy owl and their survival after that. Not only are you luring them into a place where they may have a collision with a vehicle, but you're also teaching them that humans may offer them food, which is really dangerous to their survival after you're gone.
Hmm. Well, what are some road rules of birding ethics? I mean, give them some distance to be sure. Don't feed them. Is there anything else that might not occur to the layperson that we should keep in mind if we're going out birding?
Yeah, another really big thing is callbacks or pishing, where you make a lot of noise to kind of get them, kind of flush them out of a secure spot, or play their song on your phone to try and draw them in. That can be really detrimental to them for some of those same reasons I mentioned before. But as we get a little bit closer to that spring, you know, I mentioned mid-March, they might start building their nests. That can really disrupt their whole breeding behavior as well. And it can be really, really problematic.
So, meaning to say the birds might hear a call that a human would play back on, you know, phone or some other device, and get really excited or stressed out because that's a sign to them that they interpret as it's time to breed, and maybe there isn't a mate around.
Right. It can also flush them off of their breeding territories. Then they're kind of displaced and have to start all over again, which is a huge waste of resources for them. And birds are small animals. They have fat reserves and stores that they utilize for things like migration and breeding, but it takes a lot of energy to get those fat reserves kind of built up and then to replenish them if necessary.
Well, Lindsay, thank you so much for the tips on this, and happy birding this winter.
Thanks.
Lindsay Kane is Education Coordinator for Michigan Audubon. Former Michigan House Speaker Lee Chatfield announced today he's leaving a job that he just started. Chatfield, who faced term limits in his legislative position, was named the new director of Southwest Michigan First, the privately funded nonprofit that advocates for businesses in Kalamazoo County and the surrounding area. But that was followed by a community outcry that led to his resignation today. Emily Lawler joins us now. She's lead reporter on the MLive Politics team. Emily, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So how did Lee Chatfield land this job in the first place?
Yeah, well, basically, term limits are in full swing here. So every House Speaker, when they're done being House Speaker, is out on the marketplace. And I think that people are looking for to snap up those kind of candidates because they're generally well-connected. They know a lot about Lansing and how that works. And, you know, they're a politically advantageous team member, and I'd imagine that's some of the calculation that went into hiring him.
So what was the reaction to Chatfield getting this job?
Immediately pretty bad. And a lot of it centered on his history with LGBT rights. Lee Chatfield won a primary election against a sitting state rep. How he got into the House of Representatives was basically by primarying this guy and making being against amending the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act to include LGBT rights. And, you know, he sort of made that a centerpiece of his campaign. And that's part of how he got to Lansing. And that kind of became part of his political fabric. And it did not rest well with the Kalamazoo community.
Well, how has the drumbeat of criticism built up over the past few days since his appointment was announced?
Yeah, well, Southwest Michigan really brings together a lot of business and philanthropic leaders in sort of a one space that targets sort of economic development. And it seems like, you know, a lot of those partners just weren't on board. So you saw some big players sort of walk away. Things like the Kalamazoo Promise distancing themselves. You know, you saw Chatfield himself sort of try to reverse his former stance or, you know, make some concessions, sort of walk toward what people were asking for. But I think ultimately that wasn't working.
Emily, have you heard of any concerns about Lee Chatfield getting this job beyond his political views on LGBTQ issues? I mean, he doesn't really have a significant background in economic development, does he?
That is the other big criticism that came up is, you know, he was suddenly put in charge of this economic development oriented group when really he didn't have a lot in his background that would suggest that that was a task he was necessarily angling toward or equal to. So I think people did raise that as a concern. But, you know, the other thing is Chatfield would have been moving for this job. He wasn't from the area. This wasn't sort of a homegrown pick. So, you know, I think that this would have been a departure from his career trajectory up until this point.
What has Lee Chatfield had to say about this? Has he tried to put any kind of his own frame on what happened and why he's leaving?
Yeah, you know, I think that he really did control the narrative around why he was leaving pretty well. He put his statement out on Twitter so that people could read it directly and sort of walked a line. I mean, you know, he was pretty frank about the fact that he's a different person and may have some different viewpoints than when he joined the legislature in 2014 and when he made his campaign sort of center around this LGBT issue. And one part of that statement that I found really genuine was that has some LGBT friends now in Lansing. You know, he really has evolved a lot. And it seemed like, you know, his statement made it seem like maybe he didn't think that the Kalamazoo community really recognized that, and that was one reason that he was stepping away.
Emily, does all this tell you anything about how other social conservatives might fare in Kalamazoo County, or for that matter, in statewide office?
I think what it tells me is something that's been a trend for a long time, which is that you know, it's not smart business to oppose things like LGBT rights right now. I think we've seen a growing recognition of that from big companies nationally and here in Michigan. You know, you look at things like the group that's working to change the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act right now has some big business partners and big corporate and economic development partners backing that effort right now. And I think that in the business world, you're competing for talent, you're competing for attention, you're competing for support, for customers. And I think that there's a growing recognition that you don't want to alienate a constituency or stakeholders like that.
Has Lee Chatfield given any indication about what's next for him? Do you think he might return to the campaign trail or maybe do some lobbying?
I have never thought that Lee Chatfield's political career would end with House Speaker or even necessarily peak with House Speaker. I think he's got a lot of political talent in a natural constituency in northern Michigan, so I'd be very surprised if this is the last we hear of him.
Emily Lawler reports on politics in Lansing for MLive. Emily, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.